Thank you for coming.
Welcome.
Yes.
Spotlight. Joe State.
Hello. Interrogator Paul Levitz has known me almost forever.
It does feel like it. If you're here, I'm going to assume you don't need a recitation of all the details of Joe's career and would rather spend the hour hearing some stories and some details and some thoughts in the process that you might not already have known when you walked in. So we're going to try and dive right in. We'll try and reward you with some time for you to ask some questions if you want at the end of the process. But let's talk about this long and very odd career you've had, young man.
It has been long and odd and varied.
At this point, you're really working continuously in the field, drawing as an artist, almost as long as anyone who is still active. And certainly in terms of being an award winner for the work you're currently doing, you got seniority over a lot of this stuff.
Well, since April of 1971.
Yeah, I mean that's ahead of most of the guys I can think of who came in who are still active, like Walt Simonson. Not a long time ahead, but a couple of years ahead of Walt. I think he got his first story in like really late 72, early 73. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember it exactly. And part of why you succeeded in doing that is you've done this incredibly diverse range of material that the charming Ms. Hillary Staten, who's rotating up on the screen, can help you assemble in the process. So you come into the story of comics as a reader at the beginning. Mm-hmm. What were you passionate about when you were reading them? What did you love?
I was reading Dick Tracy when I was 3 years old. So there's that. But and my father taught me to read generally, I guess, when I was 4 or 5 with Superboy comics. So I've been reading comics since I was aware of anything around me. And when I was actually actively reading comics, I guess I was a teenager before Marvel, it was Julie Schwartz science fiction comics, Strange Adventures.
Ian, you're the right age that Marvel was just starting to happen as you were getting to that. Do you remember picking up any of the first of their issues as that started hitting?
Well, I did buy and still have amazing number 15 from the stands, Spider-Man.
Battered or in good condition?
Moderately good condition.
Jonathan Ross, when he did that documentary on In Search of Steve Ditko, had the copy he had gotten as a kid that literally was shredded to pieces from the number of times he read it.
Mine is nowhere near very good, but it's still pretty decent.
It feels good to just be rereading the same pages the same way.
Yeah, I was a Ditko fan from, way back when, and, buying Ditko's Charlton stuff, Mysterious Traveler, and all those things. So.
Well, and there's hints of Steve's kind of style in how, not so much in how you compose the page, but how you draw the figure, I think.
Very much, yeah.
Your pencil line is very similar. Having worked with both of you as a writer and being used to seeing the pencils come back.
Yeah. You do have a curious take on a spot to see such things, don't you?
Yeah. We've lived weird lives in all of this, but you do see similarities in that process. And you end up with your first comics work is in the same world that Ditko's in it, almost at that moment, at Charlton on the Mystery Comics. Did you break into that from home, or were you already up in New York at that time?
I was in New York, living in Brooklyn. Actually just got married in Brooklyn at the Bossert Hotel, and which I think you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fairly destitute. We were heading off to Connecticut for a very short honeymoon. Hillary had to get back to teaching, I guess, like in the next couple of days. And I'd been thrown out of Marvel at D.C. a couple of times, more than a couple of times in New York. And we stopped at Charlton, which in Derby. So we stopped. Actually, we both went in. I got work.
I actually never went to the old Charlton offices, but that was unique among the comic companies because they had the printing press there too.
They did.
Did you get to wander around either that time or later and really see how this setup was organized?
Both times, yeah, and saw the row upon rows of little ladies with sheets of acetate and touche doing the
That's right,
color.
They would be doing the separations too there.
Ladies from the neighborhood were hired to do the color separations in-house. And they were printed in-house. Everything was right there.
So in case you don't know the technological history on that, in the pre-Photoshop, pre-computer days, basically the earliest comic color separations were done with masking. Mm-hmm. And it was literally the ladies of the neighborhood. I mean, for Marvel and DC and the bigger companies worked with plants that were based in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And I mean, allegedly the people had some kind of art interest, but basically by color, they would have a color guide and color by numbers, just fill in the area, and that would help define the printing areas.
Yeah. We can do an actual, a full workshop on how color separations were done someday, but nobody would care. I would.
These are inquiring minds.
Yes, right.
Now, working for Charlton was not a cure for being destitute, if I remember the Charlton rates.
No, I believe I penciled, lettered, and inked a page for $24. I think that was my rate.
And I know the writers at the time were getting about $4 to $5.
Yes.
That was about the standard, which was about a quarter of what DC or Marvel would pay for the same thing.
Yeah. Because Charlton's problem, they wanted to keep the presses moving at all times, so they were more concerned with having something on the presses rather than what it was. So they wouldn't pay for top talent to just fill in time.
And they didn't think it made any difference in the marketplace.
Exactly.
In the process.
Yeah.
You did horror comics or mystery comics, however you wanted to define it for them. You ended up spending lots of your career doing more lighthearted stuff, and Charlton was publishing a lot of that at the time. Did you try to do any of their teen or romance or humor comics at the time?
I did some romance books, which looked a lot like my horror books, and I was sold for. They did some, I guess they'd be crossover books with gothic girls horror.
I Married a Werewolf?
That sort of thing.
Excellent.
Yes, right. I love those books. We had a book called Haunted Love. I love that book. So, yeah.
Who was writing most of the scripts? Did the scripts come with names attached to them, or were they scribbled out already at that point?
Almost everything for the longest time was written by Joe Gill, who was on staff, and Joe would come in and sit down at the typewriter, often with a bottle of Jim Beam, and start typing. And by the time the day was done, Joe had, 5 or 10 scripts. And he had this brain that just was full of plots. And
one of the most prolific guys we ever had in the field.
He had to be.
Yeah.
And eventually, George Wildman, who was the editor, hired Nicola Cuddy as his assistant editor. And Nick had been one of Wally Wood's assistants, and that's how he was picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And he started doing a lot of the writing for the horror books, and we really hit it off because Nick's scripts had a real humanity, real sympathy, and
wit.
And wit, yes.
I think Nick always has had a great sense of humor.
Yes, he did, and so we hit it off.
So the two of you connect, and the Charlton line at that point was at least 3 or 4 years into being utterly bland and basically processed meat. There wasn't anything as exciting as a hamburger. You weren't going to the deli counter. You were going to the section of the supermarket where they have four slices of something claiming to be bologna in plastic hanging in a rack.
Yes.
And you and Nick are getting along, and you talk Charlton into doing E-Man. How the hell do you do that? It was nothing like anything that they had done since Dick had left.
Well, when Nick was hired, they kind of promised Nick he could develop a new superhero line to take the place of what had gone away with Dick. Then they decided they didn't really want to live up to the promise to Nick, so they were going to kind of sort of live up to it by letting him develop his own one superhero. So that was E-Man.
Did you guys bullshit it out together? Did Nick come up with this as a finished character idea and come to you and say, I have this script, Joe, I really think you're the guy to do it?
Basically, except he had an entirely different origin for E-Man, which I thought was awful, and I said, Nick, that's awful, but and he said, okay, I'll do an origin that's not awful, and he did, and it was fine, and E-Man is, like an intelligent energy packet from outer space. I don't think any other superhero has that origin. So
Quizlet and the Legion, sort of, but he didn't even look like a human being by the time we got there. Never thought about that similarity, actually, till just now.
Amazing.
No. Funny. Okay. So you get to do that, and for those of you who've never experienced E-Man, it's probably the most modern, lighthearted superhero of the period. I mean, there had been a bunch of attempts to create a lighthearted hero in the 1960s by the major companies, but they were generally done by really old guys who didn't get the current language and were busy throwing in words that they thought were cool. And the two of you were young and fresh, and it really was a very...
Strange to think of, but yes.
Once upon a time, we all were.
Like that.
That's a bunch of us.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And you have... who do we have on the far left?
That's me.
There. So we've got Joe, we've got Nick, we've got me in the days when my hair was larger than the rest of me.
Marv Wolfman and Len Wein.
Yeah. This is a little while after the days of E-Man.
Yeah.
So we were even younger then.
We were young. I actually had hair that came, kind of farther on the front of my head. So
So it was very fresh, very original. A lot of us in fandom were getting a big kick out of it. Nick and you spent a fair amount of time at the New York Comic Conventions.
Which was new for Charlton.
They never sent anybody to anything like that before.
Yeah.
I mean, it was new for all of the publishers, I think, at that time, to be doing anything like that. And it lasted about 2 years?
I think it was about... It was 10 issues, and there was a big gap in the middle when there was a big paper shortage. So it probably ran about 2 years.
Okay. Of course, nobody has any idea how anything sold, because Charlton was just shipping them out by the truckload in assortments and taking back stuff, and was about as mobbed up as any company in the comics has ever been.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what they tell me.
It was a mystery. So you're doing that. You're attracting some creative attention. Mm-hmm. Does Marvel or DC come knocking on your door and say, hey, you're doing cool stuff?
Gil Kane did.
Okay.
Gil called me and somebody had shown him E-Man, and he wanted to know if I'd be interested in doing layouts for him.
Huh.
So for about a year I did layouts on Spider-Man and Conan and Ghost Rider and like that. They're books have just recently been reprinted under the name Gil Kane that I drew. But after I'd been working for Gil for a while, Roy Thomas called me one day and asked me if I'd like to ink the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently penned Roy down at Heroes Time, and I asked him, why did he do that? I mean, he didn't know that I was working for Gil, as far as I know.
I mean, Roy and Gil got along pretty well, so it's possible Gil had outed you. He probably would not have said, "This is my boy who's actually been doing my work." It was not Gil's style.
That's one among many. But I fed my dad. Why did you hire me? And he says, "What story was it on? What was going on? What was it about?" He had no memory of ever hiring me. And he says, Joe, at that point, we were desperate. We were probably desperate, and somebody said, "I could call you." So I think that's how I got work at Marvel.
Well, the period you're talking about, 72, I guess, 73?
No, 73.
The Marvel line is expanding massively. There were only, in those days, about 200 creative people working in comics in America. The talent pool was thin. The older guys were aging out and not producing as much. A lot of the younger guys who were really wonderfully talented were flaky as hell. They had very specific dreams of what they wanted to do and weren't necessarily mass producers. So I think Marvel probably was fairly desperate. DC was getting pretty desperate in some of it too. Where are we going to find the next Kurt Swan, the next Gil Kane? You're already ready to kill a guy like Gil for various behaviors, but there wasn't an obvious next solution in the process.
Right.
So you start with inking. Inking in those years is very much the second tier on the art rung. And who are you inking over? Was that Sal already?
I started with Sal on the Avengers.
Sal Buscema.
And then one day, I had a package show up from our editor. Lynn Wein was the editor. And I had a package show up, and it was full of Herb Trimpe Hulk pages.
Hmm.
I called Lynn and said, "You've sent me the wrong book." And he says, "No, we decided you'd look good on the Hulk. You'd look good on Herb." So I had no idea what had happened, but suddenly I was inking Herb.
Well, let's talk about that set of transitions for a moment, because your own work on E-Man...
Can I ask both of you to speak more clearly in the microphone?
Of course. Your own work on E-Man very much leans towards the cartooniest edge of what you ever did on superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the spectrum on superheroes is sort of from cartoon to illustration on it. And you're leaning all the way over there.
Mm-hmm.
You go over to inking Sal, and he's halfway towards illustration, three quarters of the way towards illustration, maybe. His figures, at least, are very much real people with real muscles and real bodies in it. His composition, I guess, is a little cartoony.
Yeah.
Did you feel that was having any effect on your style? Were you learning anything by working on Sal that you didn't feel you knew as an artist before?
Yeah, I think so. More believable figure constructions. Some of the line work I was doing, I think, was more, more superhero than you would expect. Just matching what Sal was doing.
And then you moved over to Herb Trimpe stuff, which is, for the time, probably Marvel's most idiosyncratic artist, or one of the.
Yeah.
If we leave Barry Smith, maybe out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Herb's more cartoony. But cartoony in a very, very personal style.
Yeah, Herb drew only like Herb.
Yeah.
When I started inking Herb, I thought, here's a Kirby imitator. And then I looked at him, that's not, I mean, he's doing the Kirby stuff, but that's whatever he does, that's what Herb does. And I haven't seen anybody else who actually draws like her.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone sort of follow in any of that mode.
Right, and I tried to go back to what I could find of his own inking. He'd had
You know. He did a few pieces, yeah. Not a lot over the years.
Yeah. I tried to pick up...
Did he do that Phantom Eagle story himself?
Yes. Yeah, he did. Yeah, that was... speaking of idiosyncratic.
Yeah, how the hell did that ever get published?
Boy, could he draw airplanes. Yes. Right. So I was trying to draw, trying to ink Herb, something between Sal and what Herb would be doing. And,
okay.
So that was how I have to, you know, make it clear at this point that the way books were done at that time, you were given layouts. I don't know what you call it, layouts, roughs. It's more than a rough. It's not a finished drawing. Herb drew in blue line, so they didn't have to be erased. Herb drew in a regular gray pencil, and that would have to be erased. But they would be basically outline drawings with no blacks, no shading, no real depth. And that's what I was doing. I would take a general rough drawing and then make a finished drawing of it.
So we're watching what you're doing over on the DC side, some of us at least. We're pretty desperate too. I mean, the good news is you should have been starting to actually be able to pay rent on the Marvel rates with the inking. I'm sure the days were long. With Hillary.
You're still teaching.
Well, you know, it is. If you're working in the creative arts in America, having a significant other with an honest job is a real, real good plan.
Yeah. We had moved up to the Hudson Valley, but then. Out of Brooklyn, so we were,
Okay, and we point out, of course, this is Brooklyn long before Brooklyn was cool.
Right.
This is not the Brooklyn that all the young people want to move to now. It was the Brooklyn you wanted to move out of.
Yes.
So we're watching this from D.C.
But the fires in the St. George Hotel, nightly, so, it was a different time.
Lovely. And one of the things we've done at D.C. to deal with our desperation, as we're adding some new titles in those years, is we've started a handful of different books that are done as layouts for the first time at DC in the same approach that Marvel's doing, some of them by artists whose work is really appropriate to the kind of material, like Jose Luis Garcia Lopez doing superhero or adventure material, and some of it in the kind of Hail Mary pass of taking someone who was a really good storyteller, Rick Estrada, great cartoonist, but no one's idea of a superhero artist, including his own, and saying, Rick, will you lay this out, and then who can we get who can make it look as though it's superhero material?
Yeah.
And we call you.
You called me out of the blue and asked me, what
if you can make Herb Trippi look good. You can probably make Rick Estrada look good.
Well,
please.
Yeah, and then you said we will pay you a little more than Marvel, and we will let you do some penciling as well as finishing. And I got, a really felt I hit the a blank at Marvel because just finishing, and I did want to do some of my penciling. So you kind of offered me those two things, and I said, that's a good idea.
Cool. Yeah. And so we began playing together.
Yes.
What did we give you the pencil? I don't remember any what your early penciling assignments were.
I guess it was penciling and inking some early issues of the Metal Man. I think that was the first thing I penciled with.
Was that Gerber's? Or Marty's?
It was Marty's.
Marty's, I think. That's right. Gerber did them with Simonson. Mm-hmm. And then when Steve left, Walt gave it up almost at the same time.
Yeah.
And you jumped in after that.
So that was my first encounter with Marty.
Yeah, another long-time collaborator.
Yes, I worked on a lot of stuff with Marty.
The only thing we never lured you into was the poker game. Probably accounts for your financial health these days. So you do some Metal Men, and then we get to the point where you start doing some real solid superhero work. Mm-hmm. Justice Society is the first of the serious superhero assignments.
Did a few issues of Karate Kid spinoff with Rick's layouts, which I was doing at a Wally Woodstock.
Because Woody was the guy who was started out doing most of the finishing. Joe Orlando was the one who had figured out this whole scheme. Mm-hmm. And he was, of course, Wally Wood's former assistant, so he knew Woody can make anything look good if the storytelling's all right. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the base style that was the guideline, I think, that Joe was pointing everybody to.
Well, that's what I was shooting for. And from that, you picked me to do the All-Star. What were we calling it? All-Star Squad?
All-Star was the Justice Society.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Thank you.
So, freeze frame, it's a second before you become a serious superhero artist, basically, at this point.
Yeah.
You've been doing the second tier stuff, warming up in the wings. That Joe Staten, what did he want to be when he grew up as an artist?
He wanted to be a guy who made a living drawing comic books.
Okay.
I don't think I ever really specifically wanted to do any specific
single thing
other than I wanted to draw Dick Tracy all my life. But other than that, I just wanted to make a living drawing comic books.
That's a healthy attitude. Flexibility helps in a field like this. So you get your shot working on Justice Society. It's a young book. It just started a minute before. Mm-hmm. It's already gone through Estrada and Wood.
Keith Giffen
and Wood for a minute. Keith at a very early point in his career in a very not yet focused stage as an artist and maybe as a person. Woody doing a couple of issues all by himself. The last solid comics work he did before he passed. I think I wrote Woody's last stories, which is really, really strange. And then you get called on deck and get to do it, and we start playing together, mm-hmm. beginning of a long and very happy relationship.
Yeah.
What was your process like? Did you know these characters? Did you care about these characters? Did you have to dig in to get a feel for who they each were? I mean, you had a writer who didn't yet know how to give you any useful guidance on body language or background or anything that I would do today if I were writing it.
I don't remember objecting to whatever you were doing. But I did come into the JSA knowing who they were and having a feeling for their world, because DC had done those 100-page reprint books. And a lot of the stuff was, you know, I guess it was just being used as filler, was reprints from the 40s. And, the characters from the 40s, I was very familiar with them from that. And it really appealed to me that we were kind of off on the side. We were on Earth 2. That, I didn't have to draw, I guess Neil was doing Batman, Dick, or...
Occasionally, yeah. Irv Novick, Jim Aparo, sort of setting the standard.
I didn't have to do that Batman. I didn't have to do Kurt Swan Superman. I could do Jerry Siegel's Superman. I could do Harry Lampert's Flash.
Wow.
So I would look back all over the reprint stuff I had and try to find the old guys and try to do my version of what they did. I was trying to respect what had come before and trying to pick up on that. And since I was also picking up from Wally Wood, who was had that kind of 1940s feel his mm-hmm. whole life, and so I really felt like we were kind of off on our own bubble. Doing something that didn't wasn't held at the same account as the rest of the line, so it was kind of like we really had more room to play there.
Well, and we did arguably three stories that have had resonance for DC and for comics in general for decades and decades after. We finally told the origin of the Justice Society. You had that gorgeous. I think you've got the page in the slideshow.
Whoop.
Of Superman rising up at the last minute, smashing the plane. You might recognize some resonance to the Wonder Woman movie. Alan Heinberg, who wrote the Wonder Woman movie, did a fabulous job on it. He is a fan who enjoyed reading these stories, among other things.
Oh.
So, who knows?
Who knows?
But that story has had lasting resonance. We did the story of the end of the Justice Society, mm-hmm. Where for the first time superheroes are called before a government panel and their secret identities are demanded to be revealed, which one might collect royalties from Civil War on. might not.
Might should.
And we introduced the Huntress.
We did.
So that, I mean, that was a strange and interesting path to the Huntress, right?
Yeah.
How much of the original visual was yours? How much was somebody else's in the process? There was some tinkering there, if I remember correctly.
The process was Bob Layton was inking the book, and Bob had the idea that Power Girl, Superman's cousin, was in the All-Star Squad, and she was kind of this young woman all by herself, hanging out with these middle-aged guys from Earth 2. I mean, you know, here she is with Wildcat and Green Lantern, these old guys. And he thought, well, she really should have another girl to talk to. And Paul agreed to that. I agreed to it. And we were all, you know, off on this. I mean, Paul had some, Bob had some idea for a character, but I don't really remember any of it.
I don't think he had anything specific. Tony Tallon, I remember, had suggested a Batgirl.
Right. I think Tony was the one who came up with her being the daughter of Batman and Catwoman. That's my memory.
I'm not sure. I think so.
So I think that was the key element, and Paul picked up from
kind
that.
Kind of fit the pieces together.
And I did a design that had elements of Batman and Catwoman, and Tony colored it with colors from both of them. And I had a long session with Joe Orlando, a real nice time I had with Joe. We went over the costume and, you know, figured out, you know, what these small bits should be and how it should all go together. So, you know, it was a lot of us working on the Huntress. I'm very pleased at how she came together.
Yeah, wonderful that she's still so much a part of the story. And mm-hmm. it's just kind of funny to see old Batman and Catwoman romance stuff today when that really was the first point that anybody suggested the two of them could get together in the dynamic. So you go from this to doing a wide range of superhero material for DC.
Yeah, kind of everything.
Yeah, moments on almost every character in the line, I think.
I think so, yeah. Not to mention Showcase 100, which, you know, was... Well, everybody had ever been at Showcase.
Which was pretty close to everybody in the line along the way, except maybe Superman. Or did we get Superman in there somewhere?
I don't think Superman's in there, but Angel in the A-bomb.
Just to make you happy, Jeff.
Yeah.
You were friendly with Bob Ox.
I was.
That's
right.
Bob lived like 15 minutes or something for you in those years. Bob Ox was a wonderful cartoonist who had done the original Angel in the Ape stories. And he was great at drawing pretty girls. Yeah. Good at drawing apes.
He was really good at drawing apes. Yes.
Do you think you're better at apes or pretty girls?
I'm better at pretty girls, I think.
Okay.
But not at horses.
Yeah, you never want to draw horses. That was always on your list of can you avoid putting that in the story.
Yeah. And Bob Oxner had been an editor in some of the small comics companies in the old days, in the 40s, so you could just go hang out with Bob, and he'd, you know, tell you about the time he fired Evergreen Kinsler, you know, all those, you know, old stories. So,
cool.
Yeah, we love Bob.
So, let's flash forward to one of the stranger effects you had on... Already?
15, we end up a few minutes early, so we can get you off and get the next panel on.
Yes,
we
do.
Okay, I'm going to hit two other things fast, then I'm going to give room for a couple of questions then. One is one of the stranger effects you had on the business. The summer you went to England.
Ah.
Tell that story.
Once upon a time.
Alan Moore is your fault. Just understand that.
I'm not sure I accept that.
Ah.
However, Brian Bollock is my fault.
Well, that's why Alan Moore is.
Okay.
So tell us why.
Well, we were going to spend some time in England. We were traveling. And as I recall, we all knew British editor named Richard Burton. Richard was a friend of yours originally, right?
Fanzine editor.
Fanzine editor. And you had arranged with Richard that Richard was editing at Marvel, Marvel UK at the time. Very strange place. And he had arranged for me to have a spare board at Marvel where I could keep up with my DC work. But Richard lost that job for one reason or another. I don't know. But I suddenly didn't have the place at Marvel. But he said, well, there's this guy, Brian Bolland, who works for 2000 AD, and his wife, Rachel, is a fabric designer, and she's working on a show that keeps her out of the house most of the time. She's out working on this, but she has a board, and Brian says you can work on his board, on Rachel's board. Hmm. So, and, you know, Hillary was with me, and I would go over during the day, and Brian and I would work back-to-back. He would, you know, like, do like a half a page of layouts, and I, you know, pencil 4 pages of the Legion. But we were working back-to-back and just really hitting it off. And we were talking, and Brian, what Brian really wanted to do was Julie Schwartzian DC superhero stuff from that. And I guess, was I working with Jack Harris?
Jack Harris
at that point. And I mean, this all comes together. Mike Gold was editing at DC, and he had passed things around and given to Jack Harris, so that Jack Harris had a good stack of 2000 AD books with a lot of Brian's work at it. So I called from England and said, Jack, there's this really good artist in England who'd love to do some Green Lantern covers. And Jack says, okay, how fast? And we were...
Possibly the last time anyone used the word fast in any connection with Brian. Right.
But Brian's first work for DC was three covers for a Green Lantern miniseries. And that brought...
First British work with DC published ever.
Really?
In connecting. That's the beginning of the British invasion. That's why Alan and the rest of them are all your fault. So you're entitled to go to Alan at your own risk and tell him that and see if you can collect anything. But check in with Neil Gaiman, might give you some royalties. He's an easier guy to get along with.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I want to jump way forward to get one more story in of some work that the two of you do that nobody much knows about that we have up here, which is that these guys have been collaborating together on books to help kids' health for a bunch of years. There's a wonderful, I guess, Boston physician, Athos
Busmaros.
I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. But who's a comic fan who reached out to you for help.
Yeah. Well, it worked out that I actually put in like 13 years drawing Scooby-Doo. I drew 100 issues. I was in 100 issues of Scooby-Doo, and Athos wrote a very nice note about how much his son George liked Scooby. I did him a little drawing, responded to him. Turns out he's a real big shot in Boston Children's Hospital. He's also a comics fan, obviously, and he'd always had this idea that if you could put medical information in a comics form, that would be a great way to reach kids. And when he realized that I could draw like I draw, the cartoony stuff is pretty clear, and my wife, Hillary, who's still down there, is a writer of children's material, nonfiction, instructional materials. He realized he'd hit his prime team. And we've done books on Crohn's disease and celiac disease and medical permissions. We've done several books, some through Crohn's Colitis Foundation, some through the hospital, the Boston Children's Hospital. And we have a process. We have a team. We can,
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I guess to wrap up this part, and we'll see if we can squeeze a question or two in fast, and then you got to draw Dick Tracy.
And now I'm drawing Dick Tracy.
So the universe is very kind to you. You just keep winning Harvey Awards. Are there no other scripts existent, or are you just beating the crap out of everybody else in the strip business these days?
We try.
It's really wonderful. Speaking of the...
Oh, there's the spirit.
Yeah, the convention. You've put the spirit in a run of Dick Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working with...
Mike Curtis is the writer. He used to write Richie Rich, and he published a line of furry animal comics.
Of course he did.
A perfect background for writing hard-nosed detective material. But he knows all kinds about comics history, so he keeps on bringing in all of these crossovers. Little Orphan Annie was left on a cliffhanger. She was carried off by pirates, and we never knew what happened to her. Dick Tracy saved her.
Yes.
She's okay now.
Yeah. So, if we've got time, one or two of you who might have a specific question, if you want to go up to the mic. Mm-hmm. If not, I will ask another question or two. Yes.
What's your badge?
That's from the Dick Tracy Detective Club.
Dick Tracy badge, okay.
Yeah, I think it's from the, it may be from the 30s, what do you think?
Oh,
30s, 40s?
I think.
I think it's from the 30s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
My house is covered with things like that.
Yes, sir.
I'm very interested in what characters fans seem to like the most that you've worked on over the years.
It's almost between E-Man and the Huntress.
Okay.
Yeah, those are my two.
And GLs.
Well, one of GLs. I mean, Kilowog especially. But I think it really comes to...
Kilowog was yours, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You had another one or two.
Kilowog, Salak, Aresia. We have a claim to Guy Gardner. That was with Steve Englehart, redesigning, reinvigorating the whole concept of the Green Lantern Corps. So I do a lot of Green Lanterns.
Cool. Anybody else want to take a shot?
Mentioned family.
Oh, one thing, Hillary reminds me of something to mention. About 20 years ago, Andy Helfer, editor at DC, had a line of kind of experimental crime type books, more adult
Paradox.
And I did a three-issue graphic novel with the novelist Jerome Charon, who's like a real novelist. And it's a good story. And it didn't print very well because, the way the process I used. But now that we've done a Kickstarter, it's been fully funded. We're going to have it printed I think it will be at full size, an original size. It's a duotone process. It's picking up a dark and light tone. So it's going to be a really nice nice package. And that's urban crime, a little bit in the future.
Can you still order it on Kickstarter? Or is it closed out at this point?
I don't know.
I think it's closed now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you will have to buy a printed copy at Joe's table next year in San Diego, right?
Yes.
Or from your local comic shop, get them to order it.
Yes.
I want to say from my standpoint, as someone who did, I don't know how many dozen stories with Joe over the years, including a wonderful little one-pager in the 9/11 benefit book.
Very proud of that.
We had exhibited at the Library of Congress about 50 feet from a Gutenberg press, which is about as classy a moment as I've ever had in my career. Joe is an immaculate storyteller. His stuff always was perfect to dialogue, structure the story, that never was an issue. He knew how to take the eye from here to there, tell you who the characters were, tell you what they were about, cleanly and simply. And one of the reasons we did as many stories, because I kind of had my thumb on the scale at DC of being able to do things, was he was just the most reliable and easiest guy to work with, and a pleasure. So I kept going back and forth to talk him into something, including things you never want to do, like the Legion of Superheroes. Sorry.
I come around.
Joe didn't like doing it. Kurt Swan didn't like doing it. I had a hard time finding people who actually wanted to draw 4,700 different alien creatures and different superpowered characters that they'd have to dig out reference on. I don't know why this was a challenge. But you were good-natured about it when I'd ask.
Thank you.
Is there anything you didn't get to draw that you wanted to draw along the way?
I would have liked to have a good run on Superman. You know, I did a few fill-ins here and there, but I never got my how I never really felt how I wanted to do Superman. So.
Didn't you win an Eisner for Superman, Batman, something?
That was the animated style, and I love the anime. I'm very good at the animated style, and that was an adaptation of Paul Dini. Script. Which was great too. But I did get an Eisner for that. So, and actually, small story, the name of the book was the Superman Batman Adventures. That's what the Eisner is supposed to be for. The committee made it up wrong. It says the Superman Robin Adventures. However, that was the year that Will Eisner was sitting in a throne on the dais and giving you your Eisner, and he would sign the back with a gold pen. I am not giving that.
Joe, thank you. I mean, you were a star artist in the years where comics reached hundreds of thousands of people every month. You were a constant, effective producer in all of those years. You told stories on so many different levels. Even your Scooby-Doo run, which doesn't perhaps get as much respect in these halls as the superhero stuff, I can vouch for the fact that it was the highest subscription title DC had for many of those years, because people really loved getting it for their kids. It was widely distributed internationally, and it kept a great character in people's eyes for a long time. And now with Dick Tracy, you're reaching a whole new audience, primarily through the web. I assume there's very little print.
Very little print.
Newspaper adventure strips.
GoComics.com/Dick Tracy. That's where you find it.
But, so you've made millions of lives better along the way. And that's better than working in the factory in Brooklyn, I think. as well as being a little less desperate than that.
A little bit.
So, thank you, sir.
And thank you for being a good friend all these years.